AYS is 892-8916. That's 892-8916 or at mhayeslaw.com. Parallax is also made possible by the Chico Chamber of Commerce, committed to enhancing the economic vitality of Chico for its businesses and residents. For more information about chamber impacts and opportunities, and to join, visit chicochamber.com or call 891-5556. We got a nice little snippet from Truth Dig Radio here, interviewing Barney Frank's new book. Check it out. This is FM 90.1, 6 o'clock on Thursday.
I know our time is limited, so I'd like to get right to it in terms of the book. And I find it really interesting that when you discuss the effect to attempt to reform, you dealt with the TARP bailout under the Bush administration, and you had a criticism of the failure of the incoming president, Barack Obama, to seize the opportunity to get the banks to be more responsive to the foreclosure problem and build that in. Is that an accurate portrayal?
Well, partially. What I was, frankly, at that point, I wasn't depending on the banks so much. We had public money that was being appropriated to keep the whole financial system from collapsing. And in the legislation, we authorized that some of that be used to set up a fund to diminish foreclosures. And what happened was we get caught in the interregnum. The Bush people say, well, we're not going to ask for that money. It had to be requested by the Secretary of the Treasury unless Obama says, okay, this is in the interim period. And Obama says, well, I'm not going to ask for it because they're in power and I don't want to be charged with it. And that's when Obama says, we only have one president at a time. And I say, well, that unfortunately overstates the number of presidents we have. So to avoid any sense of responsibility for it, Obama kept us from getting the money that we could use. At that point, it was tax money that would have been used to to cut back on foreclosures.
Yeah, and there's an estimate that upwards of 50 million Americans had lost their homes or had serious financial damage.
Well, 50 is higher than I've heard, but it was a lot.
It's a lot, and the loss of, the figures I've seen from Pew Research, the loss of wealth, not income, but accumulated wealth.
No question. It devastated the wealth of African Americans and Hispanics in particular, who'd been victimized by these bad loans.
Yeah. So, I think 95% of your book is fabulous, so I'm not going to ask about any of those issues. I do want to focus on the banking, if that's all right with you.
And
the only criticism I would have is, to what degree was this a bipartisan fiasco? And frankly, and I've long followed your work, I've interviewed you and so forth, and so, I hope you take this in context, but it seems to me a weakness of the book, which is otherwise very strong, is that you let the Clinton administration off the hook, and particularly on this question of the response to the new banking situation, the Financial Services Modernization Act, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, and I was disappointed that you don't mention Brooksley Bourne, and you don't mention that, that there was a movement to rein in these collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps, and that it was people like Lawrence Summers and Robert Rubin, who are not even mentioned in the book, who led the fight to prevent the regulation of those weapons of financial mass destruction that Buffett referred to.
Well, first, obviously, I was critical of Clinton in other aspects, particularly in his budget balancing deal, cutting Medicare for capital gains. And secondly, with regard to the legislation, I did disagree with him on the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which I voted against, not, by the way, because I thought Glass-Steagall needed to be preserved because it was somewhat outdated, but because it should have been replaced by more relevant regulation. On the Financial Services Modernization Act, that one, the exemption of commodities, it is true, they fought back against Brooksley Bourne, but that legislation was Phil Graham sticking it to them in ways that they couldn't object to. So I think Clinton gets a split decision on that one. But the other point I wanted to make was, and that's a fair argument, you do have some space limitations, I wanted to take on the argument that it was government intervention as opposed to government non-intervention that caused the problem. And the fact is that the Republicans were in power for most of that time. So I agree, I should have added a couple of sentences about the Clinton people. But the more serious problem, well, for example, one of the worst things that happened was clearly a Bush thing, which was the preemption of the right of states to regulate. And that one, that was a Bush one. The Clinton people had not done that. They had not interfered with the right of states to regulate.
Yeah, well, that's true. But on the other hand, you were very critical of the AIG bailout, the $85 billion. And that was engineered not just by Paulson, but by Timothy Geithner, who was then made Treasury Secretary by Obama. And
it was done by Ben Bernanke, not Paulson. It was actually, well, Paulson okayed it.
Yeah.
And I thought the best thing we could do. Well, by the way, I was not critical of the AIG thing at the time. I think they did have this problem that after Lehman failed, if AIG had failed, and of course it turned out that AIG first said they owed $85 billion, then they said, oh, whoops, it's $170 billion, and now Greenberg is suing to get his money back. If they hadn't done that, things would have gotten much worse. What we did do, of course, was to amend the law so that couldn't happen again without the company being abolished. The problem was not that they paid some of those debts, but that they did it and kept the company in business, and they can't do that going forward.
Yeah, but the main thing was that Wall Street was bailed out, and it was bailed out both under Democratic and Republican.
No, that's not the main thing. The main thing is that
I was going to complete the sentence. That you can maybe make an argument for that, but there wasn't a comparable concern about the well-being of people who lost their houses and jobs because of these financial.
Right, I'd say two things. First of all, if we had not kept the banking system alive, they would have been hurt worse. This was not a favor we did for the banking system for their benefit alone. If the system had failed, the heads of those companies would still have been very well off. So we had no option at that point, given the state of the law, but to keep the banking system going, because you otherwise would have had a collapse, which would have hurt the people at the bottom the worst. Secondly, yes, I do agree that there was a problem with not doing more to help with foreclosures, and I did fight to try and get some more money for that. But the fundamental point here is that we were confronting this argument from the conservatives that the cause was liberals trying to be too nice to poor people. And what I do, I think, is to show that that's nonsense. And in fact, they were the ones who were protecting these bad loans when liberals, understanding that they were doing poor people much more harm than good, tried to stop them. And so it was the deregulation versus the regulation. But as far as bailing out the banks, yeah, we did have to keep the financial system going. If we hadn't, then I think it would have been much worse. The poorer you were, the worse off you would have been.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to cut to the real argument here. I think your opposition to Glass-Steagall, based on that it was going to hurt support for the community redevelopment, support for poor people, that was a valid criticism, and that was the basis on which you voted against it. But there also was a concern about merging all these financial institutions after what was called the Citigroup Relief Act or the Citibank Relief Act because it allowed...
I agree with Elizabeth Warren. Whether or not Glass-Steagall would stay on would not have stopped the problem. Unfortunately, most of the abusive practices, financial derivatives, bad loans, Glass-Steagall wouldn't have prevented any of those. Glass-Steagall, unfortunately, being 80 years old, none of the bad things that happened would have been retarded by Glass-Steagall.
Well, I don't want to take up our time is limited, but I think the ability to regulate here was a bank, Citibank. It merges with Traveler. It's done with great fanfare. The pen is given to Sandy Weill, and then Robert Rubin, who engineers the deal, goes to work for Citigroup and makes.
I think that's legitimate criticism. He should not have done that, but. That's not what caused the crisis. I was disappointed in Rubin that he would have done something to their enormous benefit and then take the job. I think he did avoided legitimate criticism. I agree with that.
Okay, and Lauren Summers also, right?
Well, he didn't go to work for Citicorp, and as I said, I voted against it.
Yeah.
But it is important to note that, again, they could have made all those bad loans with or without Glass-Steagall. That's not Glass-Steagall's fault. It was just that the problems we had were innovations that they never knew about.
No, but if they get so big, they become too big to fail, and that, of course, is what happened.
I mean, we changed that.
Yeah,
they weren't too big to fail at the time, But at this point, they are not, and they will be put out of business, and that's one of the major things we did.
Yeah, but I mean, the merger of Citibank and Travelers created the world's largest financial institution that had to be bailed out by taxpayers. It's not your fault, but that was the, one of the
and
things.
I voted against it. Yeah, yeah, yes,
I agree. So let me just ask you, because I am talking to you as a progressive leader, and so I'm trying to find out how government works. And there were only four people who voted against the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000, which you say in your book was a bad piece of legislation because it prevented any regulation of these collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps. It just banned it. And it was called was aimed at Brooksley Bourne, who was the one person in government who seemed to really understand what was going on. So I'm not blaming you for that. There were only four people voted against it.
It was not a standalone bill. It was added to an appropriations bill, which was a pass or fail, shut down the government. That's what Phil Graham was able to take advantage of. That was unlike Glass-Steagall, which was standalone and I voted against. This one, Phil Graham jammed into the appropriations bill, and then we adjourned, and it was a shutdown the government situation.
Yes, but the record is quite clear that it was Lawrence Summers who provided the key.
The point you made, which is about voting against it, the reason only four people voted against it was that it was voting against that meant shutting down the whole government, unfortunately.
Right. Okay, but just asking for your appraisal of how government works and how these things happen.
I'm giving you my appraisal.
No, I understand. But
the problem here was the procedure by which you can stick these things into a broader bill, and they did it again
on the
push-out, and that's one of the things I've tried to fight.
Right, but the Clinton administration supported that. Lawrence Summers testified in favor of it, and Bill Clinton signed the bill as a lame duck president.
Well, there are two things. First of all, signing the bill, I don't blame him because the alternative was a government shutdown. Testifying in favor of it, I think, was a mistake. Yeah, I agree. I think that and as I said, I voted against Glass-Steagall. I did not agree with that. I'm not sure what.
No, I'm talking about on the commodity futures modernization.
I understand that, and the difference is Glass-Steagall was a standalone bill, which I voted against. That Phil Graham Commodities Protection Act, the Financial Derivative Protection Act, was part of an overall bill. And the vote against that meant shutting down the government.
Right. But I just want to be clear on one point. It was supported by the Clinton administration.
And I was critical of the Clinton administration's deregulation. Look, I spent much of my time then. By the way, the committee I was on didn't have any jurisdiction there. They didn't merge that jurisdiction in the committee I served on. My major fight with the Clinton administration during the 90s in the economic area was over their supporting policies at the World Bank and the IMF in particular that imposed austerity inappropriately on Asian countries. And I waged a fight, which frankly we're finally winning now, where they tried to prevent countries from controlling the inflow of capital
so that they were
hurt by hot money.
After only a week of marriage,
the commodities issue I was not deeply involved in because it was not involved. The committee I was on did not have jurisdiction. But I did fight very hard against their deregulatory policies in the international economic area.
Yeah, let me ask you one last question about that. In the struggle about Glass-Steagall, there were some people, it was a bipartisan group of people who cared about privacy. William Safire, who by then was a columnist in the New York Times, Ed Markey, who was your colleague from Massachusetts, and they, I think even Shelby, who was a senator from Alabama, they raised this question, if you allowed insurance companies and banks and everybody to get together, they were merging the private data of people, and that there should be opt-in, there should be protection of consumers, and they appealed to Clinton to veto the bill unless that protection for privacy was built in. What was your feeling? I actually didn't.
Oh, I voted for that. I voted for the privacy. There was unfortunately a kind of a jurisdictional fight because at that point, financial jurisdiction was split between the Commerce Committee, chaired by John Dingell, and the Banking Committee, where John LaFalce was the head. And unfortunately, we had what I thought there were competing ways to do that. And this was Congress at its worst. Democrats sort of not supporting each other because of jurisdiction. But I voted for the privacy provisions, and I was disappointed that they weren't in there.
Okay, so, no, I understand that you have been a major progressive force. I'm not disputing that. I'm wondering about how to look at the Democratic Party leadership, because where was Bill Clinton on
that?
That's
when he was wrong. So, yes, I will tell you how to look at the Democratic Party leadership. As A, much better than the Republicans in many ways, and B, not perfect, and in fact, mistaken in this sense. As I said, I was fighting with them over capital controls. I did agree that there was, as I say in the book, a kind of unwillingness to support legitimate financial regulation and too much of a belief not just in the free market domestically, but sort of imposing it through the IMF and others. I think that that has changed. That's no longer true of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, let me just make clear. I think the book is a very important read. I'm not disparaging, and you know, that's why I'm asking these questions. So let me just...
Well, if you're asking me to explain Bill Clinton, I think the best thing to do is ask him.
So let me know, because it's a question of the direction of the party, and the fact
that the party has gotten much better since then. As I said, we've won the fight over capital controls as we've switched our position at the IMF after a lot of work. We've changed. We've lobbied the World Bank to drop this doing business report, which penalized countries if they had good labor laws.
So what was the fate of Dodd-Frank then? How do you assess it, and what was the role of the Obama administration? Did they do the right thing, the wrong thing? Have important provisions been taken out? Is it working effectively?
The president made one mistake when he signed that appropriations bill where it was put in to keep the government going for the full year. It wasn't a major change because it still keeps the rules of derivatives in. It allowed them to be done in the bank. It's still a great improvement. But what I'm happy about is the outcry. Nancy Pelosi took the lead, Elizabeth Warren. I jumped in. Hillary Clinton spoke out. And I am now confident there will be no further changes in the bill, no weakening that will happen until the election. But it will be, you know, along with climate change and some other things, on the ballot in 2016. Clearly, if the Republicans win, they will take us back to no regulation at all.
But is it just the Republicans? Isn't yes. Hillary Clinton very close to Wall Street, and isn't she...
And what policies have you... she, in fact, spoke out against the weakening amendment. So, you know, I think you're demonizing her unfairly.
No, I didn't demonize. I'm asking a question.
No,
I mean,
Bob, you're not just asking a question. You're raising a doubt that she's... can be trusted. That was in contradiction to my saying that I'm not worried. In fact, she's spoken out strongly in saying, let's not weaken financial reform. It must be protected. She issued a statement about that after this bill. And so I don't see the basis. You're close to Wall Street? Yeah, she was a senator of New York. Most people have relations with the businesses in their community. But in terms of the financial reform fight, she's been on the right side.
So finally, on this question, because this has been a major part of your government work, how do you assess the gains and losses in terms of this great recession? I mean, if you look at the growing income divide since the Clinton years, if you look at the loss of wealth...
In fact, it's been before that. Why this insistence on criticizing only Democrats?
Just not...
program, you're having a bad word to say about a Republican. And I think that's...
Oh, no, let me go... Oh, I can go very far on the Republicans. I think Phil Graham was atrocious in his behavior, and then he went to work for you, you know, for a bank.
Only when I mentioned that... you.
Oh, no. Come on.
Well, the income divide doesn't go back to just Bill Clinton. In fact, with the tax bill that supported, no, I'm sure the tax system actually became a little bit more progressive as a result of Bill Clinton, according to CBO and other studies.
Okay. So let's not have your time is limited. I don't want to have a false argument. But what we're talking about is whether. Congressman, I mean, there are choices, you know, and the question
that income inequality began with Bill Clinton.
No, I am saying a sharp rise in income inequality has occurred under both Democratic and Republican presidents. Right. So it's a major issue. And in terms of the Great Recession, the people who suffered were the people on the lower end. That's right. And so my concern and my question, obviously, I'm not turning to the Republicans. My concern is who on the Democratic side would wage a vigorous fight on behalf of people who are hurting. And
Obama has been moving in that direction in a number of areas. One of the things that hasn't gotten as much attention is this attack on unions. He's got an NLRB that's actually doing some good stuff to try and protect unions. You have this with the minimum wage. I think the health care bill was a move in that direction. But my point, and this is the central point I try to make in the book, we're not going to be able to deal with inequality until we free up government resources to be able to deal with that. And that's why my two major goals right now are substantial reductions in military spending and stopping the criminal prosecution of drugs. And on those, on both of those, my Democratic colleagues need work as well as the Republicans. The Democrats are better than the Republicans. Not there yet. And those are the two issues that I want to fight in the future. Free up the resources from those two things, which are unwise expenditures, and we would then be able to make a serious dent in inequality.
Right. And those are worthy issues. But you've written a book about the history of this period.
No, I've also written a book advocating that. It's not
just
the history.
Yeah. I am not critical of the book.
Please, you say things and then you back away from them. It's all like an attack on the Democrats not being good enough. Well, that's the kind of history I'm not focused on. I'm talking about what we need to do in the future.
Okay, but you wrote a book of history and you did not mention Robert Rubin or Lawrence Summers.
No, I didn't just write a book of history. I wrote a book of policy advocacy.
I know, but in that period in which you played a key role on the economy, and I don't want to get defensive here, but the fact is, I'll tell you, I was disappointed. I looked in the book, and there is no mention of Robert Rubin, who played an absolute.
Why? Because I couldn't write a book about it. It was not meant to be a comprehensive economic history. I wrote it to make my major point was to make my policy point that the problem we have is understandable resentment by a lot of white guys about their eroded economic position, and the way to fix that is to cut military spending and legalize drugs so we have the resources to do the things that will be helpful. I also wanted to challenge this conservative argument that it was government intervention rather than government regulation that caused the problem. And those were the two policy focuses.
What about the conservative argument that there's a crony capitalism, and whether the Democrats or Republicans are in power, the big corporations, and particularly the financial sector, has this enormous influence, and it was demonstrated in the Clinton years with the passage of...
I focused on the Clinton years, and I wasn't writing a history of the Clinton years, and the fact is that things have gotten better, and you're almost disappointed to acknowledge that. Here's the deal. In 2008, it is true that the financial community sort of split their money, more to the Republicans, but a lot to Obama. Since then, and since we passed the financial reform bill, and the president has been as critical as he is, and he's appointed good, tough regulators, the financial community no longer splits its money. They're overwhelmingly on the Republican side. The notion that the financial institutions have all this sway was refuted by what happened in 2009 and 2010. They did not like what we did, and they did not like, by the way, Obama, after Bush lowered the taxes on the top bracket, Obama insisted on pushing it back up again. So the argument that the two parties are equally enthralled to the big people is simply not a description of the last few years.
So were you the least bit disappointed when Obama turned to Timothy Geithner to be Treasury Secretary and he turned to Lawrence Summers to be his top economic advisor in the White House?
No, because I thought that the president himself would be making this. But again, I am struck by your unwillingness to acknowledge that anything good ever happened. You are determined to make the point that the Democrats are really no better than the Republicans. Both parties are in thrall, inequality with both. And I don't think that's helpful because the thing to do is to try and make things better. That's what I urge in the book. And I think if you look at the last 6 years, there is a clear difference in terms of financial regulation, a better tax system, less than I would like, but much, much improvement.
Yeah, so I don't dispute that, and that's not the point. The point
Why is...
Why is
that not the point? People should know about politics today.
Because where we got the radical deregulation of Wall Street came under a Democratic president.
Right, but here's the deal. It's not deep. That's your point, because you want to show that things are terrible and that nobody's any good. Seriously, Bob, that's all you talk about.
That's not true.
I want to tell people that, in fact, there's been some evolution, that the Democrats have gotten better in a number of areas, and that the way to do it is to keep that two-front war, press them to be better, and go forward.
Yeah, well, let me just be clear. I think that what Barack Obama did today, the development of a treatment, dealing with nuclear proliferation in Iran and coming up with a sense of agreement is a great achievement. I don't think President Bush would have done that. This is not my view that everything has gone wrong or there's no difference.
I'm trying to... Your default position is to be just critical of the Democrats as if, no, let's not think there's any difference. I want to be critical sometimes, as I was in my book, but also talk about the differences.
Okay, and I appreciate that you know, but let me just say, the reason I picked up on the economic reform is for two reasons. Basically, you have been a major figure in this area, okay, and in the Congress, and your name is attached to the most important bill, and it is also the one part of your book in which I do have disagreements, so yeah, I thought that would make for a more interesting discussion.
I think that's just an interesting discussion. There's an ideological point here. That's all.
Of course there is. It's not ideological. It's factual.
It's not factual when you say, as you did before, that the two parties, that the big corporations have influenced both of them through. That has not been true during the Obama years. It wasn't true with regard to the financial reform that the financial industry hated, that led them to stop giving money to Democrats. It hasn't been true in some of the international economic stuff. It hasn't been true in our support for unions, where there's a big party difference.
Okay, well, it was true that without Clinton's support, they would not have gotten the reversal of Glass-Steagall and the commodity futures.
And you're fixated on 20 years ago.
But that's how we got into this big mess.
No, I don't think the repeal of Glass-Steagall did.
And the Commodity Futures Modernization Act.
That was a terrible act, yes. That did cause some problems. But also the problems were the bad loans that were being made that weren't being regulated. And here the Democrats, Clinton was weak on that. But you want to focus on what had happened. I wasn't writing a history book about that. And I was primarily concerned about what we should do about it in the future, which doesn't seem to interest you.
Yeah, let me, okay.
How we fix things, you don't want to talk about.
Yes, I do. Let me ask you then.
Well, you haven't raised it.
Let me raise it right now. So what are the obstacles right now, or the positive things right now, in reining in Wall Street to prevent the future from recession and also to get some economic justice right now? What are you optimistic about? What do you see working, and what can we do?
The first things we can do on economic justice, as I said, to substantially reduce military spending and the intervention. And the president's kind of in the middle on this. He's had some good instincts. I'm afraid he's getting pressed to go back in. If we do not reduce the military budget by well over $100 billion and stop these ridiculous counterproductive interventions, we're never going to have the resources to do the things we need to do. Similarly, we should stop criminalizing the use of recreational drugs, which, among other things, is also where racism really bites in America, the way they're administered. As to financial reform, we're on the right track, and I believe if we get a Democratic president who stands behind those reforms, we'll be in good shape. The appointees have been on the whole good ones. There is this problem that the Republicans controlling the appropriations process have cut the funds we expected for the two derivative regulating agencies, the SEC and the CFTC, and that's been a problem. But that's going to be decided. In 2016, we'll decide the future of, among other things, financial reform, because if the Republicans win, they'll undo it all.
Okay, let me ask you, could I just switch the topic just a little bit? In terms of the surveillance state, and you have the Patriot Act, which is up for revision now, what do you feel about the Obama administration's handling of this and the whole question of whistleblowing? You know, so tell me about it.
I voted against the Patriot Act. It's gone far beyond what is reasonable. I have been particularly upset when they have gone in a couple of cases and asked that cases be dismissed so that they can be kept secret. You know, he tried to do the right thing on Guantanamo, and it was disappointing that he does seem to be unable to find a Secretary of Defense he can get along with, and that's kind of troubling. And Hagel wouldn't go along with that. But I think he's been intimidated by this national security argument, both in terms of suggesting maybe he would send troops back into Afghanistan or keep them there longer than we should, and in terms of the surveillance.
So you are concerned about that? So let me ask you, I know we'll run out of time, but it seems to me the great advance we've made in human rights is an issue that you've been concerned with, gay rights.
Absolutely.
And it happened so quickly, and we're even getting pushback now in Indiana and Arkansas, you know, and so forth. And it seems to me the key difference is that once gays came out of the closet or were able to heroically, you mentioned Bayard Rustin in your book, somebody I knew, the troubles he had with the civil rights movement, and one of the reasons J. Edgar Hoover went after Martin Luther King were his different associates, one of whom was Bayard Rustin. And what we've learned is that you can, it's very difficult to scapegoat gays because they're in every family.
Correct.
And it's not a you can't. It's difficult to marginalize. And then the problem is, how do you get that same feeling of sympathy for racial minorities?
No, I agree. Look, it is clear, it's symbolized in that 1 week in 2013 when I hit a high and a low in terms of my reaction to the Supreme Court. It was great that they threw out the Defense of Marriage Act, and outrageous that they gutted the Voting Rights Act. And here we are celebrating the courage of the people 50 years ago who got beaten nearly to death over this, and this Supreme Court gets rid of it. Now, there's no question, race is a harder one. Partly it's because it's had an economic impact that being gay hasn't had, and that's led to some differentiation. Secondly, it's because you say that white people don't have black relatives. They all have gay relatives. One thing I want to do, and that's one of the reasons why I am very much interested in removing criminal sanctions on the use of recreational drugs, because as I look at the country today, that is the area where racial unfairness has one of its greatest impacts. The unfair, racially discriminatory administration of the drug laws, both marijuana, crack cocaine versus powdered cocaine. So that's one very practical thing I think we can do to diminish the impact of racism.
And on that issue, you do have bipartisan support. I notice even Dana Rohrabach, I shouldn't say even.
This is the one place where the libertarians are true to their beliefs.
So what? Let me finally, I mean, just when you look at this landscape now, I know you're still a political person, so but as a historian, is there any kind of shift in any direction? And are we going to get a more progressive wing in the Democratic Party?
Here's what I'm hopeful of. We were on a downward slope in military spending with the collapse of the Soviet Union because it wasn't possible to argue that America still faced an existential threat from bad guys. And then Dick Cheney very cleverly seized on 9/11 to persuade people that we were under threat, that the terrorists were as big a threat as, they say, Stalin or Hitler. Clearly they're not. And then I think, and here's where the Tea Party people also come in, I think people are beginning to recognize that the terrorists are terrible people, and we need to fight with them, but not with nuclear submarines, not with the kind of $550 billion military that we've had. So I am optimistic that there is a real chance that we can get a more realistic notion of what America has to do in the world, and that that will free up resources to do things, because I do believe that a lot of these people who are voting in a very reactionary, conservative way now, they're not philosophically anti-government. Paradoxically, they think the government ought to be there to help them with their economic situation. And I think if we have the resources to do it, we can make some progress.
Yeah. In terms of the war on terror, it's in some ways for the military, industrial, or intelligence complex, it's a gift that goes on giving, right? Because you're always going to have some kind of terrorism, and then you can justify these massive data sweeps. And it's sort of disappointing that very few members of Congress have actually stepped up on this issue from either party. They seem cowed by it.
Has anything good ever happened in the last 5 years, in your view?
Well, I said this progress on gay rights, developing some sense of controlling nuclear proliferation. I'll answer that question. I think the improvement of minimum wage and organizing around a living wage, recognizing the rights of immigrants, immigrant reform, condemning torture, at least to some degree, the appearance of whistleblowers like Edward Snowden, as Daniel Ellsberg earlier. Yes, I do see a lot of positive signs. I don't know why you're baiting me with that. But
I'm not baiting you any more than you're baiting me.
I'm not baiting you. I'm trying to get... I really...
Bob, disagreement's a two-way street.
Yeah.
You know, there are journalists who think that you're supposed to be probing to us, but we're supposed to never come back. I think we have these differences that ought to be... I think you are more pessimistic and less recognizing of differences between the parties than is helpful for the political system, because I want people both to tell the Democrats to get better, but also at the given time pick the ones who are not as bad as the ones who are.
Yeah, but full confession, you know, I drank the Kool-Aid on Obama, and my wife maxed out, and I thought this was the second coming, and I'm these days quite optimistic about Jerry Brown, and I think the Democratic Party in California has, and Kamala Harris, our Attorney General, I think there are real signs of a progressive rebirth, but I do feel deeply betrayed by people who said they were progressive, and I was shocked when Barack Obama, who I was very enthusiastic for, and I even gave a speech at a Democratic Party meeting in Nevada, standing in, I think, for Richardson or somebody, when he turned to and I hate to bring up that issue again, but when he turned to Geithner, who engineered the AIG bailout, when he turned to Lawrence Summers, I thought, you're putting these gonoffs in there.
I wouldn't call them gonoffs. Political disagreement doesn't mean people are thieves. But beyond that, I think you were overly enthusiastic, and now you're being overly critical. Frankly, I was not for Barack Obama in the primary. I was for him in November. And, yeah, I can understand if you, overly idealize him, the disappointment is greater. I think he was, in both cases, a liberal trying to do the best he can in a tough situation, although I do think he's been a little too intimidated in national security.
A special broadcast right there of Truth Dig Radio interviewing Barney Frank on his new book. Does it left Democrats off the hook? Who knows? Who knows? Only you can judge. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico. That special segment was made possible by, of course, the generous contributions of you, the KZFR members, and by Friends of the Arts, a state local partner to California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts has been creating economic opportunity through arts and culture by producing community festival and events, including Artoberfest, Chico Palio, the True North Tour, the Silent Film Festival, the NorCal Jazz Festival, the Salmon Festival, and more. To learn about Friends of the Arts, visit friendsoftheartsupstate.org. Also made possible by Baird Roofing. For a hole in your roof or a whole new roof, Baird Roofing can inspect your home for roof damage by calling 342-1361 or visit bairdroofingco.com or stop by the office at 11025 Midway in Chico. Jump to the Light kicks off starting at 7 p.m. But until then, a Peace Talks Radio special about the Vulcans.
This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. On our program, we spotlight the art and science of peacemaking throughout history and in our lives today. Whether it's the search for inner peace or learning how to reduce conflict nonviolently with others in our homes, workplaces, communities, or between nations, we consider it here on Peace Talks Radio. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and I stand before the group to say that I am a trekker. That's Trekker, not Trekkie. Trekker is the preferred name for the devoted fan of the Star Trek TV series.
Space, a final frontier.
It can be someone who's into any of the different Star Trek series, but the fan base was born with the original 1960s TV series, Star Trek.
These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
My experience of watching Star Trek since 2003, when we started doing our Peace Talks radio series, has actually changed, because I began to notice how the adventures of Captain Kirk, Vulcan First Officer Spock, and Dr. McCoy, and the rest of the crew of the Starship Enterprise regularly mused on the big issues, so many of the issues that we like to explore on our program. Peace and war.
Well, there it is, war. We didn't want it, but we've got it.
Curious how often you humans manage to obtain that which you do not want.
Tolerance and bigotry.
Well, here's one thing you can be sure of, mister. Leave any bigotry in your quarters. There's no room for it on the bridge. Do I make myself clear?
You do, sir.
Freedom and justice.
But does our involvement here also constitute a violation of the Prime Directive?
We merely showed them the meaning of what they were fighting for. Liberty and freedom have to be more than just words.
Mercy and compassion.
No. No, I won't kill you. Maybe you thought you were protecting yourself when you attacked the outpost.
Not to suggest that there weren't battles with phasers and photon torpedoes and likely a hand-to-hand fight or two in almost every episode, but the careful consideration of whether the fighting was necessary in the first place was often right there in the script.
Are you afraid or aren't you?
I will not allow you to lecture me.
No one can stop me.
With the May 2009 Star Trek movie release, that acts as something of a prequel to the original series, telling how the Enterprise crew came together in the first place, I thought now's the time to explore what Star Trek actually has to offer those of us who are interested in peacemaking. For our half-hour program today, we'll be talking with David Gerrold, a longtime science fiction writer who wrote one of Star Trek's most popular episodes, The Trouble with Tribbles. He's also the author of the book The World of Star Trek, first published in 1973 and updated in 1984. We also have an hour-long version of our program that includes interviews with Indiana State University professor Dr. Judith Barrett, who's the co-author of the book The Ethics of Star Trek, and original cast member Nichelle Nichols, who played Lieutenant Uhura, the communications officer on the series. You can hear the hour-long version of our program at our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com. But David Gerrold is with us right now from his home in Northridge, California. And David, let's recap the original Star Trek premise briefly. In the Star Trek original series, it is the 23rd century, and Earth people have survived to travel into deep space and find there's actually lots of life and excitement going on out there. According to the world of Star Trek created by TV producer and writer Gene Roddenberry, Earth survived more turmoil in the 20th and 21st centuries, but eventually got its act together, in short. So, David, what's suggested to viewers when the Star Trek story actually begins?
Well, from the very beginning, this is a great question, and people have always asked, why is Star Trek so popular? And I've always felt that the reason it's popular is because it portrays a future that works for all of us, with no one left out. Everybody's included, black and white, brown and red, old and young. There's a place for everybody. There's a lot of work to do. We can't afford to waste anyone. And Gene Roddenberry himself said that. And the way I've always phrased it is that space isn't the final frontier. The final frontier is the human soul. Space is where we're going to meet the challenge. Gene sold the show to NBC as Wagon Train to the Stars, and they thought they were just getting an adventure series that took place in space. But Gene Roddenberry and Gene L. Kuhn, especially Gene L. Kuhn, recognized immediately that they could tell stories that were very pertinent moral allegories about life in the 20th century. And so you see there were stories, anti-drug stories, anti-war stories, stories about the insanity of mutual assured destruction, stories about the Cold War. There were stories that were about Vietnam, stories about the arrogance of being human and thinking we have the right to do things in other worlds. There was a lot of questioning of who are we and what is our role in the universe in that series. And I think that was one of the things that struck people the strongest, that it was Star Trek was going places in its ideas, in its storytelling, that no other show at the time was even attempting.
Yes, and many of the episodes presented fairly sophisticated discourse on war and peace. And I want to start by playing some dialogue from an episode called A Private Little War.
One of my favorites.
In short, in this episode, Kirk is contemplating arming the Hill People, indigenous inhabitants of this once peaceful planet, so they can hold their own against another faction of inhabitants on the planet, the Villagers, who've been armed with rifles by the Federation adversaries in that original series, the Klingons. In this scene, Kirk is training the Hill People on the use of old-style flintlock rifles, when Dr. McCoy appears concerned. William Shatner playing Kirk and DeForest Kelly as Bones McCoy.
Hold your breath and squeeze the trigger gently. Well, very, very, very. Jim, I want to talk to you. Not here, Bones. In the cave. Your turn. Your turn.
It's not bad enough there's already one serpent in Eden teaching one side about gunpowder. You're going to make sure they all know about it.
Exactly. Each side receives the same knowledge and the same type of firearm.
Have you gone out of your mind? Yes, maybe you have.
Bones, the normal development of this planet was a status quo between the Hill People and the Villagers. The Klingons changed that with the flintlocks. If this planet is to develop in the way it should, we must equalize both sides again.
Jim, that means you're condemning this whole planet to a war that may never end. It could go on for year after year, massacre after massacre.
All right, Doctor. All right. All right, say I'm wrong. Say I'm drunk. What is your sober, sensible solution to all this?
I don't have a solution. But furnishing them firearms is certainly not the answer.
Bones, do you remember the 20th century brush wars on the Asian continent? Two giant powers involved, much like the Klingons and ourselves. Neither side felt that they could pull out.
Yes, I remember. It went on bloody year after bloody year.
Well, what would you have suggested? That one side arm its friends with an overpowering weapon? Mankind would never have lived to travel space if they had. No. The only solution is what happened back then. Balance of power.
And if the Klingons give their side even more?
Then we arm our side with exactly that much more. A balance of power.
In this particular episode, Kirk is justifying the Vietnam War. And, remember that's 1966, 1967. Kirk is justifying the Vietnam War by saying that we need to preserve the balance of power. He recognizes that it's an ugly argument, but there is no other argument. There is no other solution. He says so. It raises issues of responsibility, the responsibilities of a superpower. And I don't have all the answers. I think that a superpower should use its power to stop wars, not foment them, and certainly not to create them. I think Star Trek is finally asking, in that episode, for me, Star Trek is finally asking the question, how do we use our power to stop wars? And the answer Kirk comes up with, to my mind, is still the wrong answer, but it's the only answer he knows.
It's extraordinary still that even the peace argument gets an eloquent airing, it seems to me, for that time. And I wonder, too, because we recently did a program about Physicians for Social Responsibility starting in the early 60s, whether the doctor ends up sort of playing that role that Physicians for Social Responsibility did in the anti-war debate at the time.
Dr. McCoy is my favorite character in the entire series, and possibly one of my favorite characters in all of science fiction, because he comes from the heart. He speaks from a position of respect for what it means to be a human being. While Kirk and Spock are always considering the logic, the action, and even the consequences, McCoy is reminding them constantly, people are going to get hurt by this. And I think this is important to remember. Anybody who's in a position of any authority has to remember, every decision you make, people are going to be inconvenienced, hurt, sometimes even killed by the quality of the decisions you make. And I think it's important for McCoy to constantly speak up and remind all of us that these decisions cannot be made in a vacuum. They're made in a context of real people with real lives.
Yes, the law of unintended consequences.
Oh, yeah.
And it's interesting to note, too, that as I watched some of these episodes, when force was applied or advocated for, in the closing moments of many of these episodes, there was more than a hint of uncertainty in the solution. And I want to play the final moments of this episode we excerpted, Private Little War, because in the end, both sides of that planet did do battle with the flintlocks, and after an ugly fight scene wherein the once peaceful hill people learned to kill, they ask Kirk for even more rifles.
Kirk here.
Spock, Captain. I trust all has gone well.
So Spock, ask Scotty how long it would take him to reproduce 100 flintlocks.
I didn't get that exactly, Captain. 100? What?
100 serpents. Serpents for the Garden of Eden. We're very tired, Mr. Spock. Beam us up home.
So Kirk's sigh and expression leave a world of doubt about the decision to arm the hill people. Do you think that was a conscious decision to make the moral of some of the stories sometimes murky?
Oh, I'm certain it was. Gene Roddenberry was never comfortable with war, having fought in war. I think it's very, very intentional that Kirk would have his doubts about the wisdom of his own decisions.
David, I know most fans know this, but let's talk about other plot points reflecting the 1960s geopolitical scene. Was the rivalry between the Klingons and the Federation of Planets meant to mirror the Soviet Union and the United States in the mid-60s?
Absolutely. And in fact, the Cold War was a very, very intense national paranoia. You couldn't escape it. It was everywhere. While we never said, oh, the Klingons represent the Russians in the Cold War, we knew that the Klingons were our Cold War, particularly after the first episode with them, which was Errand of Mercy, and ends with a peace treaty. And that's another episode where Kirk confronts the arrogance of the balance of power. So what we were left with after that was an enforced Cold War, where we weren't never going to quite get into outright open hostilities with the Klingons, but there would be skirmishing everywhere we went. That's what we had with the Russians in the 60s, was a policy called Mutual Assured Destruction, MAD for short, and a perfect acronym, MAD, because the idea was you destroy us, we destroy you, and the whole world is dead. But somehow it kept the Cold War from erupting into a hot war.
You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution, online at peacetalksradio.com. I'm Paul Ingalls, and today we're exploring the peace message in the original Star Trek television series with David Gerrold, author of The World of Star Trek. Let's listen to a clip from this episode you just mentioned, Errand of Mercy, to hear some of the Cold War rhetoric that surfaced in the series. Kirk addresses the seemingly unconcerned Organians, who occupy a strategically located planet that the Klingons are also after.
We are a simple people, Captain. We have nothing that anybody could want.
We have this planet and its strategic location. I assure you that if you don't take action to prevent it, the Klingons will move against you just as surely as your sun rises. We will help you build defenses, build facilities.
We have no defenses, Captain, nor are any needed.
Gentlemen, I have seen what the Klingons do to planets like yours. They are organized into vast slave labor camps. No freedoms whatsoever. Your goods will be confiscated. Hostages taken and killed. Your leaders confined.
Captain, we see that your concern is genuine, and we are moved. But again, we assure you that we are in absolutely no danger.
You keep insisting that there's no danger. I keep assuring you that there is. Would you mind telling me?
It is our way of life, Captain.
That's the first thing that would be lost. Excuse me, gentlemen. I'm a soldier, not a diplomat.
What the Organians don't reveal until much later, so that I presume we can have an hour-long episode, is that they are super powerful, pure energy beings who can and do force the Klingons and the Federation into a truce by making all of their weapons too hot to touch. And here's the climactic scene.
Unless both sides agree to an immediate cessation of hostilities, all your armed forces, wherever they may be, will be immediately immobilized.
We have legitimate grievances against the Klingons. They've invaded our territory, killed our citizens. They're openly aggressive. They've boasted that they'll take over half the galaxy.
And why not? We're the stronger. You've tried to hem us in, cut off vital supplies, strangle our trade. You've been asking for a war.
You're the ones who issued the ultimatum to withdraw from the disputed area.
They're not disputed. They're clearly ours. And now you step in with some kind of trick.
It is no trick, Commander. We have simply put an end to your war. All your military forces, wherever they are now completely paralyzed.
You're meddling in things that are none of your business.
Even if you have some power that we don't understand, you have no right to dictate to our Federation
or our Empire
how to handle their interstellar relations. We have the right
to wage war, Captain, to kill millions of innocent people, to destroy life on a planetary scale. Is that what you're defending?
Well, no one wants war. But there are proper channels. People have a right to handle their own affairs. Eventually, we will.
Oh, eventually you will have peace. But only after millions of people have died. It is true that in the future, you and the Klingons will become fast friends. You will work together.
Never.
Your emotions are most discordant. We do not wish to seem inhospitable, but gentlemen, you must leave.
Yes, please leave us.
Another interesting plot point in those original Star Trek stories and throughout the various incarnations is what's known as Starfleet Command's Prime Directive, which is spelled out here in this episode clip as Spock, Kirk, and McCoy land on another planet. The episode is called Bread and Circuses.
Jim, is there anything at all we know about this planet?
The SS Beagle was the first ship to make a survey of the star sector when it disappeared.
Then the Prime Directive is in full force, Captain?
No identification of self or mission. No interference with the social development of said planet.
No references to space or the fact that there are other worlds or more advanced civilizations.
Let's go.
No move! Hands in the air!
In this episode, the landing party managed to escape without much interference and let the planet evolve on its own. But in numerous other cases in this series, and in subsequent Star Trek series, the Prime Directive is broken over and over again. And David Gerald, you write a lot about Kirk's meddling in other cultures in a section of your book. You write that if a local culture is tested and found wanting in the eyes of the captain, he may make such changes as he feels necessary. And you say the series gave into what you call the American Way syndrome. Could you explain that for me?
Yeah. The Prime Directive was started out as a plot point in one episode, and I don't remember what the first episode was in which it appeared, but it started as a plot point, but one of Roddenberry's humanistic plot points of, do we have the right to meddle? Do we have the right to interfere? And it's a question that needed to be asked, not on a, just on a Star Trek level, but even on an international level. Do we have the right to interfere? Well, over and over, the answer is whether or not we have the right, we have the responsibility when people are being hurt by our not interfering. Are not taking action can sometimes be a much more disastrous course. And you could apply that to a lot of situations like Darfur, for example, or Somalia or Ethiopia or any of the disasters that have happened on the African continent because of the lack of existing structure for order. But sometimes, and I include myself, sometimes we get arrogant. We think we know what's right all around for other people. And there's a certain arrogance in saying, okay, we're going to interfere with your culture and make it better. Well, yeah, okay, but make it better by whose standards? Make it better under whose interpretation? Well, for instance, democracy. You don't just walk into a nation, overturn a dictator and say, okay, now you people are all going to vote and you'll have a democracy. No, democracy occurs when people are trained from even from the earliest age to cooperate and take votes, and you grow up with a recognition of how democracy works. It's not something that you can force on people. It's only something you can teach people.
We're talking to science fiction writer David Gerald, who wrote for the original Star Trek television series. A 2009 Star Trek movie reintroduces us to the characters in that series, so it seemed like a fun opportunity to consider how the original series tackled peace and social justice issues in its scripts. Another interesting episode that mused on the horrors of war and how it ought to spur peacemaking was called A Taste of Armageddon. Kirk's orders are to establish diplomatic relations with a planet, and when they beam down to this planet, they learn that it has been in a computerized war for over 500 years with a nearby planet. Strategic hits are theorized by the computers from both planets. Casualties are calculated, and the victims have 24 hours to report to a disintegration station so that they may be killed. The planet governments see this solution as tidy because it preserves the civilization despite the cost in lives. Again, in this episode, Kirk and his crew don't like the sound of that. They disregard the Prime Directive and destroy the one planet's computer, leading to this final scene.
You realize what you have done?
Yes, I do. I've given you back the horrors of war. The Vendicans will now assume that you've broken your agreement and that you're preparing to wage real war with real weapons. They'll want to do the same. Only the next attack they launch will do a lot more than just count up numbers on a computer. They'll destroy your cities, devastate your planet. You, of course, will want to retaliate. If I were you, I'd start making bombs. Yes, Councilman, you have a real war on your hands. You can either wage it with real weapons, or you might consider an alternative. Put an end to it. peace.
There can be no peace. Don't you see? We've admitted it to ourselves. We're a killer species. It's instinctive. It's the same with you.
All right. It's instinctive. The instinct can be fought. We're human beings with the blood of a million savage years on our hands. But we can stop it. We can admit that we're killers, but we're not going to kill today. That's all it takes. Knowing that we're not going to kill today. Contact Vendekar. I think you'll find that they're just as terrified, appalled, horrified as you are. That they'll do anything to avoid the alternative I've given you. Peace or utter destruction. It's up to you.
There may be a chance. We have a direct channel with Vendekar's High Council. This hasn't been used in centuries.
And it's long overdue. Shall we go?
David Gerald, you write that this Taste of Armageddon episode was one of the better ones, you thought. What do you like about this in the context of our conversation today?
Well, what I like about A Taste of Armageddon is that great speech that Kirk gives at the end, in which I have often said,